The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tastytrade Inc. is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Claire Otemodi. Today on our podcast, rebuilding the economy and managing a broken supply chain, real estate mogul and investor Barry Sternlicht.
The whole service economy is in a crisis, whether it's a restaurant, a pizzeria. This labor force contraction, the fact that so many people are not looking for a job, is really hurting the underbelly of the U.S. economy.
Plus, one great investor reacts to another. Sternlicht responds to an exclusive conversation with BlackRock's Larry Fink.
I do believe there is a huge role for a digitized currency.
As Larry also mentioned, I've become very interested in the blockchain technology as a whole and the digital ledger, which is going to change everything.
Those stories and others that got us squawking this morning, from the American crypto mines to the stars.
9 years old, Mr. Shatner will become the oldest person to ever go to space.
It's Wednesday, October 13th, 2021. Squawk Pod begins right now. First up today on the podcast, supply chain bottlenecks. Port congestion, especially on the West Coast, could threaten the holiday shopping season, delaying gifts from getting to store shelves and delaying your online orders. The White House announced early today that the Port of Los Angeles will move to a 24-hour service 7 days a week to ease these bottlenecks. The Biden administration also saying it has received CEO-level commitments from Walmart, FedEx, and UPS to move towards this 24/7 service, with Target, Samsung, and Home Depot expected to follow. The Longshoremen's Union also supports the move to round-the-clock operations and says it will be able to staff the new shifts. We talked about this headline today on our TV broadcast with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here's Andrew.
Today, President Biden's going to be meeting virtually with key stakeholders to discuss this deal, including the director of the ports of L.A. and Long Beach and the president of the Teamsters Union, also NRF President Matt Shea, and executives from Walmart and Target. Hopefully we keep talking about the challenges of the supply chain. And maybe Jamie Dimon says eventually we'll get through it. He says we'll get through it from a market-based system. I don't know if it's a market-based system or if the White House has to get involved. They are, clearly, but we'll see where it goes.
This is something that's honestly they've been working on for years, and they've never been able to get it together, because you need not only the workers there in the port through the whole time, you need people in the trucking industry who can be there, people from the railroads, just to make sure you're moving this stuff off the ports. And the port at Los Angeles was testing it on a Monday to Thursday, 24/7, that they started in the last month or so, to see if we could make this happen. But we are behind where Asia and Europe are. They've been doing 24/7 for a long time when it comes to the ports. We have not. And if you talk to people who have worked on some of the negotiations and tried to find a way to make it happen, you need all the parties to be okay with it, and you also need the neighborhoods to be okay with it. It's created a problem at times, because the ports are built in pretty busy areas, and the neighbors there don't want 24/7 either.
Right. Christmas is coming one way or another. It's just maybe giving, you really can't give a lump of coal anymore, can you? I used to get a switch. Switch in a lump of coal.
Get you a little natural gas to put in the stocking.
Can supply some of that.
Boeing is among the latest employers to mandate COVID vaccines for its employees. It's going to be requiring its 125,000 U.S. workers to receive the shots by December 8th. That's the deadline that was set by a presidential order governing federal contractors. In the meantime, American Airlines and Southwest Airlines said that they would comply with the federal mandate in defiance of an order from the Texas governor that barred private employers from mandating vaccines. Both airlines are based in Texas. American said it believes that the federal mandate supersedes any conflicting state laws. Also yesterday, the Greater Houston Partnership spoke out against Governor Abbott's order, saying that it does not support Texas businesses' ability and duty to create a safe workplace. Members of that organization include ExxonMobil, Chevron, and J.P. Morgan Chase. And guys, this is going to be interesting. You're receiving conflicting mandates, one coming from the federal level, one coming from the state level. So as an employer, how do you handle it?
Well, I think what's so fascinating about this is now you have businesses taking to their own hands, and how voters in a state like Texas are actually going to think about this, because on one side there's this sort of Governor Abbott freedom argument, and on the other there is a very free market argument about capitalism and businesses being able to do what they feel is the right thing to do. And the truth is that most of those businesses, I think, were very happy when President Biden and the federal government put that mandate in place, because it gave them cover to do, frankly, what as a business they wanted to do the entire time.
I'm trying to figure out the Journal's take. Basically saying that by forcing the issue, you backed some people into a corner where they're doing things where they might not have done some of these things if they weren't backed into a corner. Now they're trying to get it. It's going to take a while to all be settled in the courts, and it gets enjoined in the meantime. So
That's kind of been Dr. Gottlieb's point when he's talked to us, too.
I'm concerned about the political implications of vaccines and vaccination becoming another thing that divides us politically and culturally. I think we're going to see this fight over vaccines bleed into other realms, vaccinations for children, vaccinations for flu. And we're going to see vaccination rates decline across the country now that this is something that people think defines their political virtue.
There are a lot of legitimate questions people have about vaccines and wanting to see what happens. By forcing the issue, Gottlieb is worried that it's going to create an even more political decision that comes down.
You see this? I mean, this is like you need to try to figure out what's going to happen to Kyrie Irving. A workplace showdown in the NBA, the Brooklyn Nets announcing that star, and he is a star, one of the three. Those three guys are amazing. And they're all a lot more than just the three, but the three big stars. Kyrie Irving won't play or practice this season unless he gets vaccinated. He's currently ineligible to play in home games for the Nets under a New York City order that requires proof of vaccination to enter an indoor sports arena. Nets GM Sean Marks said that they respect his right to make a personal choice, but would not permit any member of the team to participate even with part-time availability. If he decides to sit out, he can still collect $16 million of his $34 million contract, so he can, living expenses, to some extent. It's not bad, 16 out of 34, but $18 million not able to collect. That's because the Nets owner and GM decided Irving would be paid for road games, that he would have been eligible to play, but since he can't, so he can get that, but won't be paid for any of the home games.
The interesting thing was, if you were the owner of the Nets, what have you paid for the other games? And was there a view? I think the view was that somehow the contract would have either been voided or the contract would have been broken, and therefore
he could have gone elsewhere.
He could have maybe gone to another team. Then the other question is whether another team would have taken him. If a team didn't take him, would have there been antitrust complaints or some other kind of complaint about how that would have worked? What do you think?
How many people are not going to go to work?
Not basketball.
I don't know if it's very few.
I don't know. It probably depends on your circumstances.
Making $16 million.
I think a lot of people are going to say, I quit then. At a lot of places.
I guess it's a strong job market. Maybe you could go somewhere else and find something.
Right. Maybe.
First of all, hopefully we're only talking about, my hope is this is 5 or 10% of the population. The question is whether you think that this is 30%
of the population. I'd be surprised if it was more than
10. We're at 75, right?
No. Right. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. If you think that there's,
I would be surprised if it were more than 10% of the population.
Quit their job, that seems high.
Yeah,
5 or 10. But by the way, in this environment, 5 or 10, we talk about supply chain issues.
It's an issue.
And shortage of labor and everything else. 5 or 10 unto itself is a conundrum.
When it's happening in places like the healthcare system, where there is just
And I think to some extent you could argue the same thing in the airline business. I know Southwest has been vociferous in its argument that the pilots are doing their own thing.
The more I think it is Southwest. Just
screwed up. A little tired of the boomer, disparaging boomer comments. 95%, okay? Mm-hmm. Oh, people over 65. 95%. Everybody else 78%. Okay, boomer?
You should continue to encourage.
Okay, millennial? What are you?
Encourage your other boomers.
Encourage
the other boomers.
You're an X, a Y? What are you?
I think Becky and I are X's. Yeah.
Triple X's, baby.
I don't understand. It's a family show. The U.S. is now the number one destination for, you ready for this? Bitcoin miners. That's surpassing China, Joe, for the first time. according to data released earlier this morning from Cambridge University. As of July, 35.4% of Bitcoin's hash rate, or mining computing power, was in the United States. That's up 428% from September 2020, and that's thanks to the crypto crackdown in China, which took that country's Bitcoin hash rate from 67% in September 2020 to zero. Now, Kazakhstan ranks second to the United States with 18% of all crypto mining.
I've never heard of that country.
Because of cheap and abundant coal power. Interestingly enough, Joe, one of the things that's so fascinating about this the story is, I don't know if you remember, we've talked a lot about the environment and the mining costs.
Use volcanoes, dude.
Relating,
like El Salvador.
Relating to Bitcoin. Yeah. Part of the argument had been very much around China and about how a lot of this was being powered by dirty coal. The more and more this moves to the United States, in many of the markets where you're starting to see the mining develop, the more you're starting to see this being done, hopefully in an environmentally friendly way. And this is what I think Elon Musk and Jack Dorsey and others have been talking about.
And it really is a zero-sum game, because what's you can only mine a certain amount.
Well, if it's Jamie Dimon's not sure about that part, if you remember. So I'm just saying, giving you the different perspectives.
I love the story, though. The way we keep reporting it is, we're winning because China stopped running, right?
That is true, too.
Still to come on Squawk Pod, where are all the workers? Supply chain issues and striking a proper hybrid balance with real estate investor Barry Sternlicht.
Companies are trying to stay super flexible since they don't exactly know what's happening in their future and how their workforce is going to respond to coming back to work. But I do giggle when I see football stadiums completely full.
We'll be right back.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod. Today on our TV broadcast, we heard from two big market names. The first, BlackRock's Larry Fink. The second, the one you're about to hear from, Starwood Capital's Barry Sternlicht. He's a renowned investor and real estate mogul. Now, Barry tuned into our show for Larry's interview, so lucky you, we're giving you the highlights of that Larry Fink interview, plus Barry Sternlicht's reactions to it. Here's Joe kicking things off.
Barry, it's good to see you. It's been a while. You got a lot of fingers all over a lot of different pulses. In other words, you got businesses all over the place. How's it going in terms of reopening, in terms of supply chain and cost pressures, and in terms of overall rebounding from the pandemic?
Where do you want to start? I mean, let's go to our basic.
How's your business? How's real estate, I guess, in Florida?
So real estate is very strong. Probably one of the strangest occurrences out of the pandemic was the rapid increase in home prices across the country. I don't think anyone would have thought that if Americans were seriously worried about their jobs and their futures, they would have gone out and bought houses at ever higher prices. So I think that's one of the big surprises of the COVID period was really the housing market. And then, you know, some of the asset classes in real estate, like industrial, well, they stayed strong right through the crisis because companies were scrambling to produce, you know, fix their e-commerce platforms, fix their distribution and get their products from the e-com, from the websites to their homes. So industrial just went right through it. Apartments took a little pause. And a lot of landlords, including us in the public, we have 105,000 apartments in our portfolio today. So we didn't want to raise rents while people were worried about their jobs or when panic was in the streets. So in 2020, the whole industry took a time out. But lately, the apartment market's been the strongest I've ever seen. What's shocking about apartment rent growth is it's nationwide and it's double digit from Jacksonville to Phoenix to Seattle. Rents are flying. And it tells you something about the consumer. I'll come back to the consumer in a second. And then you have the office markets, which we've all been sort of scratching our heads. Like, when would they fill? When would they recover? Most of us expected the office markets to get physically full again. Most of them are leased, by the way, after Labor Day. But the COVID variant came and the whole curve flattened. And so, but now we're seeing across the country, you know, even in Texas, you're only about 40% occupied. In New York City, probably like 25. That's physical occupancy in an office building. But we're up to like 35 now in Manhattan. And if you go to all, if you look around the world, which we have assets all over the globe, you know, it really depends where you are in China, in Korea, in the Middle East, they're in their offices. And then you get to, you know, some of the blue states, or the darker states, New York, San Francisco, those are really tough markets for physical occupancy and actually total occupancy because they're not absorbing the space that they were. One interesting phenomenon of this recovery in the office market is companies like WeWork and shared offices getting a disproportionate share of new leases, because I think companies are trying to stay super flexible since they don't exactly know what's happening in their future and how their workforces are going to respond to coming back to work. But I do giggle when I see stadiums, football stadiums, completely full, 105,000 fans at a college football game, or out of San Francisco, the 49ers game, you know, and they're packed and then nobody wants to go to the office. So I find that kind of interesting.
Bear, did you see when that Merck drug, we heard about it and the market took off that day? I mean, that we need that. That's going to help. And I think that will help with what you were just talking about, people returning. Yeah. But then I want you to comment on what the heck is happening in the labor force right now.
That was my next comment, because okay. You get to hotels, you run into the labor force. And people ask me what I might talk about this morning, and I said, I'm going to talk about Janet Yellen and how wrong she is about the economy. I mean, there's 6 million unemployed, but there's 11.5 million jobs that are open, and we can't find the whole service economy is in a crisis, whether it's a restaurant, a pizzeria, a laundromat, a small shop. Amazon can raise wages, no problem. They're making $1 trillion, the richest man on earth, or second richest man on earth now, I guess. You know, they can go to $15, $16, $17 in a warehouse, but mom and dad can't do that. So this labor force contraction, the fact that so many people are not looking for a job and the labor participation rate has dropped, is really hurting the underbelly of the U.S. economy. And it can't really fully recover until these people come back to work. I was at our Brooklyn hotel last week. We employ 220 people. We're missing 40 of them. We can't find them. They won't come back to work. It's not even what we pay. They just won't leave their house or whatever it is they're doing. Maybe they're trading crypto. I mean, they're not leaving. So I think they have to change the way they form this incentive. They should actually pay people a bonus for going back to work and getting back in the labor force off federal programs and state programs, frankly, and get back to work. And then they can tax them because they have a job. So, you know, it would pay the government to give people an incentive to go back to work, because it's going to cripple this recovery. It is a crisis. You walk around New York City, which I happen to be sitting in right now, and a lot of restaurants haven't reopened. And I hear they can't get labor. I'm an investor in one restaurant, and they waited to open for 5 months until they could find a staff sufficient to actually run their restaurant. So, you know, big business isn't hurt by wage inflation. And frankly, it's just hurting small business, which is the Democrat constituency. And it's really it's an interesting thing. They're overdoing it in the wrong direction. All these support programs coming in the $2 trillion or $3.5 or $1.5 trillion package, they may exacerbate that problem and encourage people to stay home. And the country can't really work without its service people back. White collar jobs are here. And we have no problem with wage inflation. I mean, thank God, it's great. And if you look at the stats, the lower wage earners have gained the most percentage wise. Obviously, it's nominally not that much money, but that's the way the economy is supposed to work. But we should do that with a full active labor force, not with this fictitious shrunken labor force that's a result of these government programs.
Yeah. And hand in hand, the government can't do this without the cooperation of the Fed. And people more and more say that the Fed is enabling a lot of this by, you know, by keeping interest rates low and buying, you know, the in bed sort of partners in crime in terms of enabling all this. And then you have the labor force not growing, it keeps them in there. It keeps them in there that they've got cover to stay where they are because there's still jobs not being filled. So it's almost like a vicious circle. And what they're doing is actually exacerbating it, like you said.
The Fed has a problem because if they raise rates, you know, the U.S. economy with the deficits, as far as the eye can see, the interest expense is going to choke off other spending programs. And you wind up just increasing your deficits endlessly. We just obviously need a responsible government with paying attention to how they spend money and not believing money grows on trees. It kind of is a good segue to crypto, by the way, and why crypto is interesting. But we'll get there in a second. The one thing I wanted to also mention is how rich the consumer is. I mean, if you look at the stock market, you act about volatility. You really have two stock markets today. You have the one I grew up on. I went to business school. I learned about discounted cash flows and a company's ability to pay dividends and grow. And then you have a complete casino society, a complete total speculative bubble, whether it's the meme stocks or even some of the multiples on the tech companies that are impossible to imagine. And the number of companies losing money, you know, and the market cap is an all-time high. There's a lot of warning signs that we're in 2000, 2001, before the NASDAQ dropped 82%. Offsetting that is almost $3 trillion of excess savings that Americans are sitting on, in companies being tons of cash, debt service levels, very accommodative, very cheap. And the consumer is rich. It's so interesting. This is a recovery where there's completely price insensitive. We can post almost any rate we want on a hotel and the place is full. I mean, it's kind of, and that's why you're seeing companies easily being able to pass on cost increases and supply pressures and craziness to their consumers.
Here's an inflation question for you, which is you're seeing inflation, but then at the same time, I don't know if you heard Cathie Woods, also a big fan of Bitcoin and crypto, which we can talk about in a moment as well, who actually thinks that we are going to ultimately see deflation over the next 5 years as a function of technology. What do you make of that?
I don't believe it. I mean, Larry Fink mentioned deglobalization, which will have serious impacts on deflation and imported goods.
I think our movement away from globalization, our movement away from consumerism to more domestic job and job creations is going to, you know, further the advancement of wages, but will probably create a more inflationary regime.
And technology, I think, is an enabler, but the wages will, you know, this shrunken and shrinking workforce and commodity price pressures. You know, in our industry, real estate, construction prices are up about 14% year over year. And that's before the energy complex took off. So piping, PVC piping is a derivative of petroleum. So asphalt for communities is a derivative of petroleum. Those haven't even hit yet. And if, God forbid, and we want them to pass the transportation bill, the infrastructure bill, if they pass that, imagine the supply bottlenecks for steel and concrete and piping. And so I think maybe 5 years from now, maybe it'll slow down. But I've said before on your show, I think inflation is higher inflation than normal, but it's going to stabilize at a higher rate than we've seen in the past. And it's good. I mean, inflation that's driven by wage inflation is happiness for America. It helps the middle class and helps those in need. But inflation that's driven by crazy policies is not good.
here's the dichotomy, though, on the Cathie Woods view, which is that she believes that there's going to be deflation. At the same time, she's a proponent of crypto. Where are you right now?
For me, and I think Novogratz has come on your show and talked about it, it's a diversification. And I think, you know, what Jamie Dimon talked about, I mean, gold is kind of worthless too, and silver. I mean, they have some industrial uses, but they're minor. It's a store of value. And the reason I own Bitcoin is because the U.S. government and every government in the Western Hemisphere is printing money now to the end of time. And this is a finite amount of something. And it can be traded globally. And people have fiat currencies, whether it's in Nigeria, and I'm not picking on Nigeria, I have no idea if they have a fiat currency, or, you know, Bolivia or wherever, you can move into something that probably has, that the world has accepted as a substitute for gold. And since it's a 18 million float or something like that out of 21, you know, I think Bitcoin it's the biggest. It may not be the one, it's a dumb coin. It has no real purpose other than a store of value. And it's a little crazily volatile. So Ether, which is right below it, I own some of that. That's a programmable Bitcoin. And then there are tons of other coins that are built off of that system. And as Larry also mentioned, I've become very interested in the blockchain technology as a whole and the digital ledger, which is going to change everything.
I'm probably more on the Jamie Dimon camp, but I'm not a student of Bitcoin and where it's going to go. So I can't tell you whether it's going to be going to 80,000 or zero. But I do believe there is a huge role for a digitized currency.
We're probably in inning one of the internet. And I don't know when the internet started, 1990, 1992. It'll be the same evolution.
I see you as a realist with a conscience. That was the first time I heard someone say, you know, for Larry, you know, ESG, if you're going to do it, the part of the G might be genocide, might not be a great thing to be in there, not just governance. And I thought that was a really good sort of to use ESG. You're going to be, you know, dealing with all these other things, but perfectly willing to go to the biggest polluter in the world, put all your investments in China, deal with them and look the other way for genocide and everything else. What should American businesses be doing in terms of a country that might take over Taiwan in 2 years and is getting increasingly aggressive in a lot of different parts of the world? Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, you know, when I asked myself and my team, we just had our LP conferences for our funds, and we just closed a $10 billion fund, which we have $100 billion in assets under management today. So we're not investors directly in China. I tend not to, it's not a China thing so much as countries where we feel like the deck is stacked or we can't underwrite the political risk of the investment. It's just, why bother? For multinationals in the United States, the interest in the Chinese consumer is extraordinary. I mean, the growth of the middle class and the ability to buy product, it is the fastest growing, most important consumer country in the world. And that's why you see all these companies sort of not knowing what to do, because it is their growth engine for many companies. So I think, you know, I do think Taiwan is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. I think not only obviously would they take advantage of this administration and what they saw in Afghanistan, but also, you know, we're not going to go to physical war, but we go to trade war. That will hurt us, those $600 billion in trades import from China that Larry mentioned. When you cut off $600 billion of couches and TVs, and then Taiwan produces all the chips, as you know, I've heard it in your show before. So, I mean, it would be strategically a nightmare for the United States. I hope our Secretary of Commerce, who I heard on your show the other day, actually races to figure out how to produce semiconductors will be more important than oil for this country. So we need to build a national backup plan. Forget about oil reserves. We need a semiconductor reserve because your washing machine will stop working. So I think it's a serious issue. I think that is the canary in the coal mine. That is really the risk to the equity markets, because we will most likely start with a sanction, you know, global sanctions against China, which could, you know, they think in 100-year intervals. We have investors that buy companies for weeks, not even months. So, you know, they will wait us out. I mean, this is their dynasties, and we don't organize ourselves like that. We'll throw CEOs out of earnings on a quarter. So, you know, they have a huge competitive advantage. It happens to be right next to them. And, you know, I know Japan is obviously incredibly concerned, and we ought to be concerned. And this is above my pay grade, but it is something that definitely worries me a lot about how to end what is a fueled rally based on liquidity globally. I mean, there's so much money chasing, you know, property values. Going back to real estate, property values are soaring across in almost every asset class. Cap rates are falling, yields are coming down. And capital is chasing property because it's in a form of yield. And it is not just a U.S. phenomenon. It's around the world. People are looking for yield, safe yield. And if you think inflation's coming, real estate's a great place to put your capital for a while, because construction costs are new products, cost so much more to build than the existing stock. So it's a very attractive asset class at the moment. I love my boring industry.
Hey, Barry, having said that, if that's the place you should put your money when you look at all these concerns, what do you think about the equities market? Because you've spent time there kind of looking through things too. Is that not going to be the place to invest?
Well, as I said, there's two markets, right? And rising rates, maybe some of the capital will come out of the tech is basically the market. And by the way, tech has never been more important to the real estate markets. Driving New York City, Berlin, all these cities are the expansion of Facebook, Google, Apple, Tesla. So they are the net users of space in global cities around the world. As they continue their rapid expansion around the world, you go to a city where where Google isn't yet, like Berlin, and you know they're going to build there's kids there. It's a great city. It's fun, pubs. So I think I think the equity markets are basically they should come down, other than the fact that there's so much money in it. So the perception and also the ability to get in and out, the Robin Hoods that make it seamless to trade. You know, but there's a whole speculative economy out there. I mean, Dogecoin, you put that up on your or Dogecoin, and that's a totally worthless coin. That was started as a joke, and that is sort of that. And Shibu are basically I have a friend who trades crypto during the day and DJs at night, and she's trading NFTs. You know, and I just feel like it's like a, I don't know what the right word is, a Ponzi scheme. I mean, the last guy when the musical chairs stop, people say, why did I spend $300,000 on a digital monkey, which is completely useless, other than other people all over the globe. It's a global phenomenon getting on. Maybe that's what they're doing. Maybe they're all trading crypto and these coins. You see, I found two coins the other day that I thought were amazing. One is called Up Only. What a great name for a token. The other one is called FOMO Baby, Fear of Missing Out Baby. Look them up. They're real coins. I mean, they have like $200 million market cap. Somebody made $200 million on a name. Fear of missing out, baby, is exactly what the cycle's about. It'll probably go up 7,000% this week. It went up 6,000% last week.
Yeah. All right, Barry, thanks. They're playing the music. I was just laughing about it. Hey, guys, think if it's above Barry's pay grade. What would that mean for how far it's above our? I don't think you get to use that expression, Barry, because I don't really think there is anything that is above. Is there? Is there anything above Barry's?
Barry had the other Barry Diller used to say that's below my pay grade.
Below. Yeah, I think that Barry ought to use that. I think that might at least be more realistic. I know it's just an express. Anyway, Barry Sternlicht, great to have him on. Haven't had him in a while. So much more. We didn't talk vaccines or anything
that's
with
true.
Him either. Mandates.
We'll have him back soon.
Yes, we will. Still to come, Squawk Idol.
My big three, Shatner, Grassley, and Clint.
We'll explain when we come back. Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation. You're listening to Squawk Pod from CNBC.
Stand and by in 3, 2, 1.
Stardate 10.13.21. William Shatner, James T. Kirk, and three other crewmates scheduled to blast off from West Texas in Blue Origin's new Shepard rocket. They're going to fly to the edges of space. About 90 years old, Mr. Shatner will become the oldest person to ever go to space. I think he's getting a free flight out of this one. Would you take the flight, Joe?
No.
Still not?
No. I'd go to.
We should say we love Shatner. Do we? We should get some
you
old
know
tape.
How much I love Shatner.
I know how much you love
and
Shatner.
He's been on the set
yep,
a lot.
He's been with us.
And you remember Jim Carrey did a great, we have traveled back yep. in time. If I could tear this.
There we go.
I did Carrey's imitation for Shatner.
I'm a doctor, Jim. I can't read this teleprompter.
And he looked 60 back then. That was a few years ago. And neither one of us.
60. He looks great.
Yeah, neither one of us have aged. Unfortunately, he still kind of looks younger than I do. But he is some type of special. Listen to, did you hear Becky laughing? I thought that was current, Becky.
No,
that was current.
That was then.
that was you, Becky.
She's not laughing now.
Yeah, my big three: Shatner, Grassley, and Clint. Those are my big three. You'll have idols. So you have an idol already, I think, don't you?
I have plenty.
Who's your idol right now? If I had to pick one, I could come up with a funny one, but I'm not going to do it.
I don't know. Let's leave it alone.
Dolly Parton.
I don't know what you're going to say.
Dolly Parton's amazing. And she stepped it up even through the pandemic. She's funny. She's classy. She's always relevant, and she stays current. She's amazing.
See, she's got one. Now you got to come up with one. Come on.
I'll come up with my other idol.
Fauci.
Haha. That's it for today's Squawk Pod. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. Listen and follow Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Clara Dumody, and we'll meet you back here tomorrow.
And we are clear. Thanks, guys.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.